I have had the privilege of meeting all of our speakers, and they're wonderful people already. I'm just getting to know them. Our first speaker today is Ben S. from Tempe, Arizona.
Good morning. My name is Ben, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Ben.
Wow. Thank God Clancy's speaking today, huh? I got to tell you, I had to do a lot of thinking about this one. I came in here. My sponsee and dear friend and hunting partner, Dale W., put my name in to speak, and I was selected. And while I'm honored, I could have killed him. No. When I saw the size of this room, I was like, oh, no. But anyways, the last thing I ever wanted to be in my life was an alcoholic. And my father was a cruel, mean, abusive drunk. And I hated him with an absolute passion. He seemed to take particular pleasure in tormenting me because I was like a mama's boy, I guess. My mom was a daughter of a preacher. I guess alcoholics can pick him. I know I did. And he picked one. She didn't drink. Dad was in the Air Force, fathered three kids. All of them turned out to be alcoholics. He was put on antabuse in the Air Force and went to some drug counseling, but he drank on the antabuse. They finally ended up discharging him because of his drinking. He, as I said, was cruel, mean, and abusive. My mother would hide me at the neighbor's house when she worked. And one of those particular nights that I remember, he came to the door, and we were having dinner at the neighbor's, and before she answered the door, she told me to get under the table. And I remember the tablecloth, you know, and hiding under there. And in utter fear that this guy's going to get me again. And sitting there listening to her tell him that I wasn't there. You know, lying. And didn't know where I was. And, you know. The last thing I remember with the relationship with my mom and dad was seeing my dad push my mother out the window in the living room. And she landed in the bushes outside, and of course the police and the whole. There were many of those kind of episodes. It was pretty nasty. I really can't remember any good things to say about my dad. I know that there had to have been, but I just that's all I can remember is bad things about the man. And then, so you would think. If, with my knowledge of alcoholism or my hatred for the alcoholic, that I'd be on the lookout, watching out for alcoholism. But I never gave a second thought. It didn't enter my mind at all. I was a shy, introverted kid. I was living in fear, and I found alcohol. I started at 13 years old. It was my first drinking and drugging. That's when I started off. And my stepfather came to be, moved us from California, from Ventura, California, to Phoenix, Arizona, to get us away from the drugs. And when we got to Phoenix, I didn't have know anybody that was doing drugs like I did at the beach. So we found some booze sitting behind a bar. They had it stacked up because some bottles had broken. And us kids, you know, 14, 15, we took all of them. We took them down and we hit them. And that was my first experience in drinking. And I loved it. I absolutely loved it. Alcohol did for me, it really did, what I could not do for myself. It allowed me to feel a part of life. It allowed me to talk. It allowed me to... I identified with the kind of people that I hung out with, and my friends were from broken homes and alcoholic fathers, and we got along, and I had some good relationships, and it was it was fun. And if it was working for me today like it was then, I wouldn't be up here today. I can guarantee you that. But I often wonder, why don't they teach what we learned in Alcoholics Anonymous in school? Actually, I had a friend ask me that. When I was in a treatment center, he came down and spent the day with me. He's a non-alcoholic, and he listened, and he said, "Wow, why don't they teach that stuff in school?" And I've often wondered that myself. And then I was thinking the other day, well, you know, as much as you ditch class, they might have taught it. You would have never known. I mean, I ditched an entire, I never signed in. They never knew I was supposed to be there, so I was just gone the entire thing. And it did have to do with something about, living and one of those kind of classes. It wasn't math or something. But anyways, I enlisted in the Navy after I had a fight with my stepfather. Wow, sound like the 17-year-old. I had to get my mother's signature list, and I was underweight. And there's a lot of drugs and alcohol in the Navy. I ended up being discharged from the Navy as a result of my my drug use. I was doing fine, just coming up the scale, and then tried to drive on base one day with a bag sitting on the dashboard, and it didn't go over well at all. And I was in aviation's electrician's mate. I worked on helicopters, and they once they found out that I had done those drugs, my life was basically over. I mean, I was on the helicopter washing detail and the commode cleaning detail, and it wasn't going to end. Yeah, and but at any rate, while in the Navy, I met my wife, Angie. She's the best thing that ever happened to me, next to Alcoholics Anonymous, because without AA, I wouldn't have her. We got married. We lost our first son, and she was 8 months pregnant. She had an accident, and the baby was killed. And it was obviously it was hell. And it was a forbidden topic. We didn't talk about it. I wouldn't talk about it. I didn't want to talk about it. It was another strike against God. I've been adding them up, taking tally. And it was a final strike. And I remember yelling in that hospital hall saying, "There is no effing God." And that was it. And I went back to drinking, went back to the bar. And I drank more and more. I'm a blackout drinker. My last drunk was horribly embarrassing to my wife. She had her sister in town visiting, and it was a pretty strange event, the whole thing, because what had happened is I went to the bar, and I went with my buddy Tom, and we were drinking buddies, and we're sitting there, and we had just discussed whether or not we thought we had drinking problems. And we had come to the conclusion, well, we'd had this discussion many times, and we'd come to this conclusion that, yes, we had, and we were going to go to AA tomorrow. And the only reason we knew anything about AA was his dad was a recovering alcoholic. And I said, "Oh, so we're going to go to AA." So I went home and decided that I needed to, there's this liquor cabinet with all that good booze in it. And if I'm going to AA tomorrow, I lined them up from the least to the fullest, and I started my way uphill. And I got stumbling, bumbling, drunk. And Angie comes home with her visiting sister. And she comes in the house, and I'm just, And she, wow, how embarrassing for her. And she says, "What the F is the matter with you?" I said, "Oh, I'm going to AA tomorrow. I'm going to Alcoholics Anonymous." She's so embarrassed. And, God. And the last thing I remember before the blackout, she said, what is your effing problem? And the last thing I remember was that finger. Maybe you're my effing problem. And I woke up the next morning. And I'm, wow, it's sunny outside. Shouldn't I be at work? She had turned off the alarms, and that was the straw. And she's done. And she's going to take the kid, and she's leaving me. Unless I got professional help. Now. Today. And you know what? I knew she meant it. What I didn't know was she already had this planned out. That she was waiting. What she wanted to do was get me help so that she could leave me. She wanted to leave me, and she didn't want a drunk showing up at her door in the middle of the night, banging around and causing her grief. And that's what our relationship had deteriorated to. And, you know, I learned in Alcoholics Anonymous the hell that I put my wife through. And it was hell. I got it. You know, my sister came to visit us in California. We were living there, and they went out shopping, and I was asleep. And my wife Angie forgot her key, and they came home, and I forgot my key. And so, the natural thing to do would be to bang on the door, and Angie says to Sherry, "Oh no, no. We'll wait till he wakes up because of the rage. You know, what Angie knew would happen, and it's exactly what did happen. Because, see, my sister had grown up with me. She didn't care. She went up and banged on the door. True to form. I answered the door, and I'm blood vessels bulging, and I'm rawr, just anger. And my sister just goes, shut up and get out of the way. Walks by me, you know. Well, that's people that live with us long enough. That's how they get, baby. But Angie wasn't that way. I put her through hell. I know today that I constantly ran her down. I constantly told her how stupid she was. I know today that I was trying to make myself feel better at her expense. You know, I learned that in AA. You know, when you talk about amends, these are amends that I can never, never fully write. I can say I'm sorry. But only by the living amend of trying to do the best that I can with the tools that AA has given me, do I have a prayer at getting remotely close to settling this score. Other amends that I've made, they never. Sometimes they don't turn out the way you think they're going to. I went to make my amends at work because. Yeah, I always thought I was a pretty stand-up guy because I have this amazing ability to rationalize and justify my behavior. Of course, I learned that here. If that employer had paid me what I was worth, I wouldn't have to steal from him. Huh? I could rationalize anything. It's bizarre. And so I go to make amends, and I sit down with a guy, and I tell him at work what I'm going to do, because that's what the book says to do. You know, I need to do this. And he stops me, and he says, Ben, I want you to find another way. He says, if you insist upon doing this, I have no recourse other than to let you go. Wow. And that's, he says, you're a good employee. I value you. I want you to find another way. And I'm like, oh, God. So I go back to my sponsor. What am I going to do? You know, some things are so simple to some people, but I mean, I didn't get it. He told me to work overtime and not build a company. And then until the score was settled, I can guarantee you it was more than settled on several occasions. You know, the other thing I've learned about amends, and this is for me, is if I make a direct amend, then it's a done deal. They don't bother me anymore. Direct being one-on-one, eyeball to eyeball. Let's deal with it and make restitution. Then they don't bother me anymore. If I make an indirect amend for me, and that's when I choose to find something good to do to right a wrong that I did in the past, where I think to do it directly would injure them or others. If I choose that route, my experience has been that it has resurfaced in my mind throughout my sobriety. And I have to, I end up finding another good deed to do to compensate for my bad behavior. That's just my experience with amends. You know, when I was, I got to tell you about my, I got sober, by the way, August 19th, 1986, in Mesa, Arizona, at the Easy Desert Group Alcoholics Anonymous. And that was my first meeting. And when I went there, this place was a rundown house, and my wife had to take me. I was scared to death. And there was stuffed upholstery furniture, and the stuffing's hanging out, and the place wasn't all that clean, and there were potholes in the driveway, and it's like, wow. And I went in there, and the worst thing they could have done is at the end of the meeting, they got up, and they said the Lord's Prayer. And I went, oh, my God, that religious cult just let me out of here. And But the one question I was asking them is I wanted them to tell me if I'm an alcoholic or not. I didn't know, because I didn't want to be an alcoholic. An alcoholic's what my dad is. Tell me if I'm an alcoholic. They said, you know, you keep coming back, you know, 30 days. Well, but this, and that wasn't good enough for me. So Angie took me down to EBAC in Phoenix, and they said, well, there's a treatment center, and I ended up at this treatment center. And they said that they could help. Yeah, they could tell me. AA wasn't going to tell me. They could tell me. Take this test, do this. And I ratted my wife out. Oh, yeah, you know what? She's done drugs before. She ended up getting admitted as well. So it was like, yeah, it's just. But at any rate, that AA place I found beneath me. Oh, I'm not going to go there. So in treatment, they want you have to go to AA meetings. Well, the second, you got to go to AA meetings, get a sponsor, do these things. So do you know that most AA meetings appear to be in churches? And I have this God thing. It wasn't working for me. So that Easy Desert group became my home group. And thank God it did, because I got to tell you, sobriety is the absolute best thing that has ever happened in my life. When I was 2.5 years sober, I got an opportunity to go to England with my family, and we went over to Britain and did the AA thing there, had instant family. It was fantastic. While there, at 6 years sober, I got a letter from my father. He's a recovering alcoholic of 23 years at the time. And I get this letter, and I open it up, and he's talking about how much I loved him. And I'm like, wow. And then but what he said was that he had spoke in front of several thousand people. And in his closing remarks, he had said that he asked the group in their prayers to remember his children, that if they were alcoholic, that they would be fortunate enough to find Alcoholics Anonymous. All of us did get sober. What are the odds of that? We're not all sober today. That's not his deal. But you know, when I read that, I'm an alcoholic, for Christ's sake. And I have a resentment. And I read that and I said, well, that son of a bitch. He's taking credit for my sobriety. That's me. That's how it works. I'm telling you don't want to live in here. It's pretty bad. But anyways, we made arrangements to see my dad after I got back from England. And we got back in December. He died in February. And I didn't get to see him. But I went to his AA funeral in Liberal, Kansas. I think it was called Club One. And it was all these people got up and talked about this guy I didn't know and how much they loved him and how much he'd done for him. And, yeah, it was amazing. I mean, this was in a Friday afternoon, and there's over 100 people there, and it was really healing for me. Yeah. I went rummaging around in a podium like this one, and I found an unmarked tape of him speaking, and he talks about himself and getting sober and his, you know, a kid. His mother died when he was age 2, and he ran away at 13, and he just didn't have, you know, much of a life going on until he got married, and how regretful he was that the men that he had made a decision that to not make a direct amends to the family. It was his decision. Yeah. He had decided he had nothing to offer and that it was best left alone. And in this tape, and I got to tell you, I do cherish the tape. To me, it speaks of what AA is about. But in this tape, he talks about us kids, and he talks about being mad and stamping his foot and saying that that there wasn't no man going to marry his wife and live on his money, and he ain't going to do this, and yada, yada, yada. And how regretful he was that he ever did that, and how it got away from him. And I think what my dad was doing in the end was trying to set matters right, and I think if given enough time, we would have got it done. But unfortunately, it didn't happen that way. You know, as an AA guy, I'm proud to see what my dad did. I am. It's, you know, the guy that I wanted to be the least alike, in a lot of ways, I'm the most alike. It's a miracle. You know, I'm just glad that he found this program, because if he got one-tenth of what I've gotten out of it. My wife is, now we've been married for 35 years. I wouldn't have had none of that. It's like two different lives in one. It truly is. Okay. With that, I'm going to close. And, you know, one thing I want to leave you with is that I owe everything to Alcoholics Anonymous, and it's a debt of grit I can never repay. So, thank you.
Thanks, Ben. That was wonderful. Our next speaker will be Joni E. from Largo, Florida.
Good morning, everybody. This is really scary. I was so nervous this morning, and I came up with a wonderful line to introduce myself, and I forgot it. My name is Joni, and I'm a very grateful alcoholic. My sobriety date is February 8th, 1987. It was the day of my last drink. I never have had to have another drink again. The things that I've been taught in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous have been the truth all the way through the line. I was very, dishonest, self-centered, arrogant, egotistical. I can get down the whole list. I was a very dysfunctional person. I did not come from a dysfunctional family. I was the dysfunction. They functioned just fine. Mom was an elementary school principal, and my dad worked for the airline. There was very little alcohol in our household, very little drinking in our household, very little talking in our house. Nobody expressed emotion, and you didn't talk about anything that was happening. I have one sister. She's the good child. I'm the other one. I'm the one that made things lively in the household. She tells the story the same way. That's where we part company on our stories, actually, because she lived an entirely different life, including times when we were in the same room. Clancy is talking now about his story, and one of his major topics is the disease of perception. You know, and I see things one way, and the rest of the world seems to see them differently, and that's probably because I don't really see too much that hasn't got to do with me. If it isn't about me, I'm not really interested a lot of times. I'm getting better at it all the time, and I do really care about a lot of people, but when I got here, I didn't care about anybody but me, and that's how I lived. I cared about me. If it wasn't about me, I would try to make it about me. I was the center of my universe, and I would like to be the center of yours, except that I didn't want you to really talk to me too much, because then you might find out who I was, and then I would have to leave. When I was 16 years old, I started to suffer the first of very serious consequences of drinking and the insane way I was trying to live. I was a bar drinker at the age of 14, which is ridiculous. I don't know why they were serving me, except that some of the bartenders that served me are in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous now. One of them's in the room now, as a matter of fact, just walked in. Ben brought his big book, and Marita brought a clock. I brought my own hecklers. They're through the crowd. Amazing people in this room today for me. It's an amazing, amazing thing. One of them will tell you that I changed my story 4 different times in my first year of sobriety. I still hadn't come anywhere near my own story, but I was working on it. It was like a creative writing class in early sobriety. When I was 16 years old, I was told by nuns in a home for unwed mothers that I was trash, I was irredeemable, and I was going to hell. And, they had like the full battle gear in those days, there's really the whole, and you got to believe them, you know who they are. And they told me that there was no hope for me. And I had no morals, and that there was nothing that anybody could do to save me, because I refused to repent and I refused to agree that I was doing things wrong. I refused to do anything. It was real simple. If somebody wanted me to do it, I didn't want to do it. If somebody told me to do it, I wouldn't do it. If somebody told me what I couldn't do, that's what I wanted to do. And if she told me that, that I couldn't ever get sober, I probably would have gotten sober. But she didn't tell me that at 16. Nobody told me anything about my drinking in those days. They told me that I was a terrible person, and I believed them. I really did. I believed every word of it. So I left there filled with guilt, shame, remorse, but I had a career path. I was going to hell, and everything was going to be okay, because at least I knew where I was going to end up. Now, it was my job to figure out how to get there, but I tried many, many different paths. I changed everything over and over and over again. I tried so hard. And one of the problems that I had in my life was trying to make amends to my family my mother's the principal of a school, and I have done something to absolutely humiliate her. And I tried very hard in those days, but I was an alcoholic, and there was that pull towards who I really was inside myself. And I would really try, because it was the right thing to do, because I knew intellectually that I owed them an amends. But I didn't really care that much. And I would get busy over here, and, I'd have a couple of drinks, and it wouldn't be so bad. And then pretty soon it would be their fault, and pretty soon it would be, look what they did to me. And then, I could be the victim, and then I don't have to make amends anymore, and who cares? I have so many different, different types of lives that I can tell my story a lot differently, because I tried so many ways to fit in the world, and I could never fit in the world. I had fit in the world in that dumpy little bar and with the jukebox playing, one of those really great places where you can smell a men's room when you walk by, and the kind of place, the real warm and cozy, and the priest had called it a den of iniquity, And I thought that was a great place to go, you know. And I didn't know what it meant. I had, you know. But the priest didn't like it. I was going. Wow. I tried so many different ways to do this. I am here in Alcoholics Anonymous as a direct result of the steps being exactly the same everywhere. I am so grateful that Alcoholics Anonymous has this book with the instructions, and that if you get sober in California and you do what it tells you to do, you can go and face somebody in New York that you never want to see again. And that's my sister did that. My sister in 1986, I was the last one on her list when she got sober, and she was doing her amends, and she did not want to see me. If she never saw me again, she would be fine. She lived in California. She got sober there, and they told her that in order to maintain her recovery, she was going to have to make amends and make direct amends. No letters, no phone calls, face to face. She came to New York in February of 1986 to see me. I was not pleased to see her. She said, now I've forgotten this until I told her I was doing this panel. And she said, I hope you tell the truth. And I told her that I try to make her look good when I talk about this, because it really is a very important part of my sobriety. It's the beginning of my sobriety. But she says that when she walked up to the front door of my house, I said something unpronounceable, that I can't say on the microphone. And then I said I didn't know if I should open the door or slam it in her face. Thank you, God, for letting me open the door. I let her do what she had to do. I was not happy about it. I didn't pay very much attention to what she was saying to me because she wasn't talking about me. You know, she was talking about herself and who cares and just get it over with and go home. You know, little Miss Wonderful, little Miss AA and her little God thing. And, you know, she's just so wonderful. And I got to tell you, while she was talking, I got really thirsty. So I drank something like a case of Michelob while she got going, and she got really going, and I got really going, and I have no idea what she said. I asked her years later to please repeat it, and she says, nope, you were there. That was the good, what you got is what I gave you. She talked about what she had to do. She did what she had to do. She made her amends. She talked to me about whatever it was that she was upset about, because she won't repeat it. She really will not tell me again. I don't know what she was upset about because I wasn't listening to her. But somewhere during that night, she turned that and she used another step and she 12-stepped me. And she did it really well. And what she did was she talked about you. And she told me who you were. And she told me how to get to you. Well, actually, I wanted to know how I could help somebody else get to you in case I knew somebody who might need help. So I did listen to some of it. I listened to so much of it that I had all of the instructions, and that's what I needed, was the instructions on how to help somebody get there. What do those people do? But I heard some good stuff. Something else happened that night. She went back to California. After attending one meeting, she only attended one meeting in New York, and she went to a group called 12 at 12 in Oceanside. She met a woman there, and she cried apparently at that meeting. She asked them to please save me a seat because she knew how sick I was. She also ruined my drinking, which is what happens. You know, you get that message, and boy, and it kept coming back to me. So I would call her, you know, late at night when I didn't have anything else to do and I had had a few drinks. And I would call her and I would get more instructions and more information. So she told me that I should call the hotline and that they would send over two women and they would take care of me. And that's what I heard her say. Well, we had to clear up the God thing first because I couldn't do the God thing because, you know, the nuns told me I'm going to hell and I'm, you know, I can't do that. So I'm not going to do that. So we discussed this. Now, I hate to correct other speakers, but Mari said last night that God's name is Harold. I think it's her accent. His name is Howard. I had a teddy bear that I named Howard, and that was my higher power. And so I had the higher power thing taken care of. I knew the instructions. You call a hotline. The two women come, and they take care of you, and everything's okay. That's as far as I figured it out. February of 1987, after doing more yes and having more bottoms and making my life truly, truly unmanageable, recognizing that alcohol was beating me. Alcohol had turned on me so badly that I couldn't function. I made that phone call. Well, as my story goes, nothing went the way that I thought it was going to go, but, you know, it went the way it was supposed to go. There were no two women. I called the hotline and asked for the two women to come and get me. And that they apparently didn't know who the two women were that were assigned to come and get me. But one man finally, they couldn't find a woman to come and get me. They could not find a woman who would come out and get a drunk. And finally a guy volunteered and he said he would come and get me. And he took me to a meeting. Where did he take me? 12 and 12 in Oceanside. There's some members of that group sitting in the room tonight. Some of them were there that night, including the woman that had spoken to my sister when she asked them to save me a seat. And she's in the room tonight. And she gave me her phone number that night. I didn't use it, but she gave it to me. I got free of alcohol. I had done a first step, you know, so many times over and over during that year. I knew alcohol had just destroyed me. I knew that there was no hope for me if I couldn't stop drinking. I had to stop drinking, and I could not drink, and I could not not drink. My daughter tells me that I was screaming in the middle of the night, praying, asking God to make it stop. I did not ask him to send me to AA, but apparently that was his idea of stop. February 9th, 1987, I woke up and I said to my daughter, "It's okay, it's over." And I started doing those things that I could. I couldn't do very much because, you see, if I did the steps, then I was going to have to bump into some of those other problems. I also had, you know, a different way of looking at things. I have a higher power named God, you know, named Howard, and I have a sister that I can call in California and ask anything I want to know because she knows everything. And now I've made her the AA guru, so she knows all about this. And I call her late at night. I'll ask her the questions. But so now I get there, and I know that I have a second step in my life before I walk in the door because I realize that I knew that you people didn't drink, and I knew that you had some kind of power that made it so that you didn't have to drink, and that's what I needed. So I came in here on step two. Step three, I wasn't going to do because of the God thing. Didn't have to do it. Turning my life over to nobody, thank you very much. I was doing just fine if I just didn't have another drink. If I didn't drink, I could handle my life. Look at me. I was doing great. I had done so much damage, of course, that I didn't recognize it. I wasn't telling anybody what the truth was. My whole life was, you know, like a deck of cards that was waiting to be thrown around the room because it was a mess. But I knew if I stopped drinking, if just stopped drinking, I'll be okay. And just stop drinking, I'll be okay. And so I held on to that don't drink and go to meetings for a while. Now, I wasn't going to get a sponsor, really, because if you get a sponsor, you're supposed to listen to them, and I wasn't going to do that, so there's no sense in doing that. I did get a temporary sponsor because they told me, in New York, you go and speak at 90 days. I think back at that, and I think, how insane is that? I hadn't even heard anybody for 90 days. I didn't know what they were talking about. I hadn't heard anybody but me for 90 days. So I go to a speaker meeting. They tell me, okay, you're going to be the second speaker, and thank you for that because whatever the first speaker said, I said. And That worked so well that I did that for a year and a half. I used her story for the first year and a half. And everybody said how wonderful it was, how honest I was, and how genuine I was. And the woman who made me give back that story is sitting in this room now. You know, I looked at those steps when I finally cleared up just a tiny bit. I got away from the alcohol. I'm not drinking. I'm going to meetings. I'm running as fast as I can. You know, I'm starting to change the outsides. I got a new wardrobe. You know, I got a little mini skirt. So I'm wandering around in, and I'm just as cute as could be. I have a little Farrah Fawcett hairdo and makeup that, you know, like raccoon's eyes or something. I got a daughter who's going to college now, and she's a little upset at my past. She's got green hair. She's wearing black leather and chains. She's about 4'11", filled with anger and rage and resentment. My son had gone out on his own journey, which I didn't know that he had the problem because, like I said, I didn't think about anybody but me. He had gone into the Navy and was writing his own story. And I was a mess. And I was just as, I didn't find out until I moved to Florida that what I was stark raving sober. I was so dry that it's too bad I was smoking because, you know, I was a fire hazard. And I had the excuses why I couldn't do the rest of the stuff. You know, you'd stop at 3. I can't do 3. I can't do anything else. 4, you know, I can't do step 4. I don't have to do step 4. I'm not like you people. The nuns told me I have no morals. I have nothing to inventory. It's very simple. 5, I got to go talk to God again and tell somebody about my story. Well, I just told you I'm not telling my own story, so I'm not talking to God. And I don't really want to know myself what I did, so I am not doing 5. Obviously, 6 and 7 you can't do if you don't do 4 and 5. Don't have to worry about those. I'm crossing those steps off the list really quick. I am racing down this line. The next one that I come to actually that I liked was 8 because I found a T-shirt that said, made a list of all those we had harmed and asked God to remove them. And I like that. That was a good idea. So, now 9 comes along, and I look at this 9, and I'm thinking, I will do my amends to those people when they do theirs to me. I had, for every person that I had harmed, I had what they had done to me first. You know, if they hadn't done that to me, I wouldn't have done that to them. So they made me be the person that I was. They were terrible. 10, 11, and 12, they were totally irrelevant. They were totally not going to happen. You know, I'm not getting that far in the steps. It doesn't make any difference. However, there was one that I really kind of liked, which was 13. So I speeded right along. I jumped right up to 13, and I went off, and I had a wonderful time. And I didn't drink, and I didn't drink. And I got crazier by the day, and I didn't drink. And finally, somebody confronted me with the fact that I was going to die of alcoholism. I was going to die of untreated alcoholism. And this is a guy that I didn't really know very well, and he really got in my face. I was 3 years sober, and I was a mess. And I said to him, well, you're so smart. What do I do to fix it? And he said, you meet me on Thursday nights and we're at this little group down in Long Beach, and we're going to do the steps. Yeah, that's going to fix it. My life is totally insane again, and it's getting worse by the day, and I'm unmanageable, and I'm crazy, and now I'm at the point of being more willing. I'm still not working on doing well and honest. I'm still not too open, but I'm getting that little bit of willing. And so I listened to him for a little while, and I went to that meeting, and I started to work the steps with him, and I got to look at my life in terms of what this higher power really was and the people that he had put in my life. And going back to that night where my sister sat in my house against her wishes and delivered that message that she was supposed to give, and how amazing was that event. My grandpa's sponsor, Polly, says, and great events will come to pass. And I saw by going over that, my story, the real one, what had been happening and how those great events had been coming to pass, and those people were showing up at just the right time. The right person showed up at just the right time to give me just the right piece of information. And I started to recognize that there was a God in my life that I didn't have to be afraid of. And it wasn't the God that they threatened me with when I was a kid. And I didn't have to be afraid of that God anymore, and that God started to come into my life more and more. I spent a great deal of time working on those steps, and my nine-step amends list was very, very long. I had 186 resentments on my first fourth step. And some of them were institutions, which I could break down by the number of people in the different departments. So I had a lot of work to do. But I did. I got to pretty much to the end of the list, and then I was able to move to Florida. I had done most of the wreckage of my past was at a place where I was okay, and I was able to move to Florida where I could move around a little bit better. I had injured my back. I didn't have any money because I had, you know, all the damage I had done, and so I moved to Florida and figured I'll go lay on the beach for a while and, you know, maybe hit some meetings, and I'm going to be okay. Well, they told me to raise my hand and meet people, and I did. And today I am the alternate delegate for the South Florida area because they let me become a part of them. And I've been able to do the last of my amends. The last person on my amends list was my sister, and she would never allow me to do anything other than be sober. And I would say to her, I need to do my amends. And she said, no, you're sober. And our mom was dying a couple of years ago. Now, I had made my amends with my mom. And but she was very, very ill, and she had mental illness. I didn't know she had told everybody I was dead until I got out there into Arizona. I had made my amends, but apparently they weren't accepted. My daughter lived out in Arizona. She had been helping take care of my mom. And at the end, my mom wasn't speaking to me, but you taught me the right thing to do. My daughter needed my help taking care of my mom, and my sister needed my help taking care of my mom. I flew out to Arizona, and I helped at the end of my mom's life. And I was able to be my sister's big sister when her mother died. And that's the amends that I really owed her, because she never had a sister. And she saved my life, but at least I was able to be there to be a little bit of comfort to her at the moment that she needed me. And I never would have done any of that except that you taught me to do that. You know, there's a lot of amends I can't make. There's a list of amends that I can never make. I had a lot of husbands, but only a couple of them were mine. And So there's a list there, and if you think you're on the list, I'm sorry. There have been so many times that I have been able to meet somebody, and I've expanded that story of my, you know, the wreckage of my past, the wreckage of my present. You know, I try not to do too much more damage. I try to be a part of today. I try to pass on the right message. I get to sponsor people. I get to tell my story, and I get to tell things that I was so deadly ashamed of. And I tell them from the microphones of Alcoholics Anonymous and the podiums, because somebody in a room may have lived what I did and done what I did and now has permission to come and talk to me and say, well, how did you go past that? I was able last year to sit with a woman who had been given up for adoption, and I talked to her about my story, what had happened to me in the home that I was in, and the way that I was treated, and my perception of the way I was treated also. And when she, a very short time after, found her birth mother, and her birth mother didn't want anything to do with her, but she understood, because you taught me to share what had happened, and you taught me to share from my heart what had happened. I feel that a lot of that is making amends to the people that I harmed, and to that child that I gave away, the boy, there's a man somewhere in this world that I gave away who may not know my story. And she didn't know what was probably her mom's story, but now I was able to help her to understand, and that's what I think I'm able to do with that story of mine. So now I'm her not mom, and she was able to get past that piece of her story, because if her mom didn't, it wasn't that her mom didn't want her, it was her mom, she knew her story could have been like mine, you know, and she could understand rather than need to be understood. I have the freedom today because of you. I thank you today for every minute of that freedom. Thank you for sitting here so quietly and being such a great group, and for this wonderful, wonderful event. Thank you.
Thanks, Joni. That was great. And our third speaker will be Marita H. from Palm Springs, California.
Good morning. My name's Marita, and I am an alcoholic.
Hi, Marita.
Hi, gang. My sobriety date is November 1st, 1981. My home group is the fifth tradition group of Alcoholics Anonymous in Palm Springs, California, and they continue to teach me how to love and be loving, and I really appreciate it. And now I'm going to take off my glasses so most of you will disappear. I can talk to this size crowd. I happen to know the poor guy who's running this convention, and Ricky's done a lot of work for 5 years to make it as successful as it is. And I made the mistake a couple of years ago of saying, Ricky, just, you know, if you need anything, let me know. You know, Okay, I know the next convention chair, and I told her already I'll do anything you need except speak. I've learned. I'm always trying to learn from my mistakes. You know, I have to tell you that I liked travel. I liked to travel a lot, and I did none of it when I was drinking. None of it that I remember. I'm the kind of drinker that would wake up and I would have tickets in my pocket. You know, I've been someplace, but I don't remember where it was. And so I spent a lot of money and don't know anything about where I've been. I, too, was a bar drinker at 14. I come from a really exciting, interesting home. My mother is paranoid schizophrenic, and my father was a depressive. And I thought everybody lived like we did. I'm the third of four children, and we were born and raised in Pennsylvania, and three of them live in Texas, and I live in California. I think that just kind of explains where we come from. You know, and I was taught early on that they did the best they could. And my mind understood the day that they did the best they could, but my heart didn't get it. It took me a long time in Alcoholics to understand how this thing really works. The longer I've been sober, the more amazed I am that it really does work. I mean, we are, somebody said, the sickest of the mental ill. You know, we look good on the outside, but we are so sick inside, and we're the ones that don't want to admit that we're sick. You know, I like to say it's their fault, or if you had the problems I had, or whatever. I always tried to stay under the radar. I had two brothers that bore the brunt of my parents' craziness, and I was the third child, and I had learned from them just stay low, you know. That's the way I operated, made sure I looked great on the outside and I could do what I want when nobody was watching. The way I would cope was drink as often as I could, as much as I could, whenever I could. I don't know what heavy social drinking is, but I sure wish I could find out, you know. I have some brothers that do drink, and they seem to be just fine. They don't seem to have any problems as a result of their alcoholism. I know that my alcoholism would have killed me. It started with the inside and worked its way outward. I did all the logical things. I also was raised Irish Catholic alcoholic and went to Catholic schools. And my parents sent my brother to a psychiatrist because he kept running away from home. And the psychiatrist told my brother, get out as quick as you can and as far as you can. And so my brother chose the Vietnam War rather than my family. So when I was about 15, 16, my parents made the mistake of sending me to the same psychiatrist. And he told me the same thing. He said, I'm going to tell you what I told my brother, your brother. Get out, get as far as you way as you can, as fast as you can. But you know, my brother ran away from home and broke every rule there was, and it wasn't very successful that way. And so I stayed under the radar, and I got a scholarship to college and left town, moved 1,000 miles away, and took a deep breath. I knew that if I moved and got away from that family and those issues and those problems, I'd be fine. You guys know the difference. Within a year, I was married to a depressive who was bipolar and drank a lot. But you know what? It was really nice because he drank a lot. And I did too, you know, because if you had the problems I had, you'd drink, you know. I spent a lot of years drinking with that man, and I don't know that I know him. You know, and that's a terrible thing to say. He's the father of 3 children. We had 3 kids in 3 years, Catholic, you know. And I don't know who that man was. I just know that we were probably 2 really hurt, scared kids. Somebody said yesterday in a meeting he took a hostage and they had a hostagettes, you know. That was us, you know. That's what I did. It didn't work. I thought I'd try church again. That didn't work. I tried politics. That didn't work. You know, I came up with every solution I could find, and nothing worked. I had to drink to be okay. I worked for the Secretary of State in the state of Illinois, and I was a hearing officer. My job was to handle drunk drivers, accidents out insurance, all the bad boys of the highway, and you guys would come see me, and you'd tell me how wonderful you were, and you'd bring your sponsor in with you, and you know, you'd just rah-rah, and I'd sit there, and I'd listen, and I'd give you back, you know, licenses to go to meetings or go to work, and sometimes you get your permanent license back, and not once did it ever occur to me that I could have a problem. I just didn't think. I didn't want to think. I didn't want to feel. I didn't want to think. I just kept making the motions, you know. The idea of living one day at a time almost sounds easy now, you know. I tried to stay in the moment because everything else was too painful. It was when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous that they said, well, you know, I'm 2 drinks shy. And I went, that's it. You know, after I've had 2 drinks, I'm okay. I feel an equal with everybody else. I feel okay, but I don't ever stop with 2 drinks because I want to feel better, you know. I have the disease of more. I always want more, more of everything. And even when I get exactly what I think I want, it's either not enough or it's the wrong color. Then I need more all over again, you know. That to me is the disease of my recovery. I have to protect myself from wanting more. So when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, my drunkalog is just like everybody else's. You know, I didn't get here because it was easy and it was fun and it looked like the next thing on the list. Ricky and I talk about this, the guy here, talk about this and about Alcoholics Anonymous being the last house on the block. You know, if there was another house for me to go to and try something else, I would have. So I really love being in this room because it's like the last room on the block. You know, and so people who come here really want to know how the steps work. It's funny that we're talking about amends, because when you think about amends, they're right after the 9th step. And I mean, right after the 9th step are the promises. And I wanted those so desperately in my life and had no idea that they even existed. So, okay, my kids are 3 kids in 3 years. They all get the chicken pox. I take 6 weeks off from work. I work for the government. They don't care. You know, they say, okay, we understand. You've got a family. No big deal. So I go back to work, and I had a supervisor. I was the first one that was a woman. I was the first one that wasn't an attorney. So I had a boss who lived in the other end of the state, and I would check in with him, and he had a boss I had never met. Well, this boss that I had never met was a woman, and she called me up the day I came back. And she said, "How are you?" I don't remember anybody ever asking me, "How are you?" They'd say, "How are the kids? What's new? What's going on?" She said, "How are you?" And I burst into tears. I'm sure that's not what she expected. Everybody knew that I had taken all this time off because, you know, I had these kids with the chicken pox and you got to stay home with kids and all sorts of jazz. And I said, "Well, I quit sober. I quit drinking and got sober yesterday." When I think about that now, I think, this poor woman, you know. Here she's trying to be kind to some other woman working in her field, in her, you know, in her department, and she's going to probably talk about chicken pox or something, you know, on a Tuesday morning. And I have to tell her I got sober and I'm a mess. And she said, "Oh." And she was real quiet. And she said, "Do you want to go to a hospital?" Now, I told you that my mother is a paranoid schizophrenic, my father's a depressive, my husband's a bipolar. I know all about hospitals. I had no idea the treatment centers had just opened up. And I said, "I don't need a hospital. I'm okay." And she said, "Okay, I'll make you a deal. Why don't you call me once a week and we'll just kind of check in and see how we're doing?" I said, "Okay. You know, what do I know? I don't know how the steps work. I don't know how anything works in Alcoholics Anonymous. But I know it works because you guys keep showing up in my office. And you keep getting sober. And you look scrubbed up and clean and usually with a tie on. And you seem to be okay." So I said, "Okay, I'll call." So I called this woman. And about 6 weeks later, when I really know I'm well, I think it's now time to approach the subject with her. And at this point, we're on a first name basis, and I say, "Elaine, you know, I probably haven't been the best employee I should have been, you know." That's called the understatement of the year. You know, by normal standards, state employees aren't the normal employee. And I'm not even a good state employee, you know. Because I was a hearing officer, I worked in three offices, so two offices always thought I was at the other one. That really works well. And any time they called, they didn't have cell phones, so they would call the office, and they would always know that I must have been in a different office, and they'd all say, "Well, there must have been a schedule change." Well, there was. I wasn't in any of those offices. And when I was at those offices, I know that I used to sleep with my door closed and my foot up on the trash can to sleep, and they would bang into my door when they try to open the door. That would wake me up. I'd turn around, shuffle my papers, let the next person in, and I thought no one would ever know, you know. So I tell this gal, Evelyn, "Well, you know, I probably haven't been the best employee in the world," and she pounced on me. She said, "Really? And how would that be?" And I said, "Well, you know, I don't give you 100%. And she says, "Oh, so you've been stealing from the state of California, or state of Illinois, have you?" I thought, "Well, no, I was just trying to say I was sorry and kind of cleaning this up so I could move along." And I thought, "Well, I don't think I'd put it that way." And she said, "Well, I would. Between now and next week, I'd like you to make a list and kind of figure out how much time you owe me." And I thought, "Well, this is a little personal. This isn't how I thought the steps worked." You know, I thought that I could just kind of make a quick and easy apology and I was done. You know, that was, check that step off, you know. But that wasn't the way it worked, and I didn't know that. I was about to get a valuable lesson. So the next time we call, I say, "You know, I think I owe you about this much time." And she says, "Let's double it for the time you forgot." I said, "Okay, fine." Because I know at this point, you know,
don't talk much and you don't get in much trouble. So I say, okay, fine. You know, I'm willing to get along because I'll find a way out later. And she said, okay, do you want to write a check? And I said, oh, I'm sorry, maybe you don't understand. I'm newly sober. I have a job that doesn't pay well. And I have 3 children to support. And she said, that's nice. So you'd like to donate the time instead? I didn't know what to say. Because I thought I was just going to say, I'm sorry. And that we, you know, clean the slate off and I could start over because I'm a new person. And she said, no, that's not how I think it works. And I thought, oh, she might know something here. So I said, oh, well, you know, that's funny because I thought maybe I'd send you a big book so that there's a chapter to the employers and you could see how it works. And in my stupidity and arrogance, I mailed the book to her. And so what she decided was I worked Tuesday through Saturday, and there was an office in downtown Chicago, which was maybe an hour and a half from my house. And she said, why don't you start working in my office on Mondays? I thought, well, that's my weekend. What will I do if I don't have my weekend? And I said, well, I'm not sure that I can. And she said, I'm pretty sure you will. I said, what time? You know, just go along. I thought, you know, give her a couple weeks, she'll get used to this, and I'll be able to take Mondays off on occasion and just make more and more Mondays off, and we'll move on, you know. So I start showing up on Mondays in her office, and she puts the big book right there, and she says, you know, I haven't had a chance to read it. Why don't we sit and read it before we start working? Oh, my gosh. You know, I have to read with this woman I don't know who's my boss so that she can learn how to do this that I don't really care if she learns or not. You know, I'm just trying to get along here, you know. I say, okay, that would be lovely. Thank you very much. She said, great. Starting next week, why don't you come in an hour early? Okay, so now I have every sober woman I have met and all their sponsees taking care of my 3 kids so that I don't have to pay for babysitting so I can get up an extra hour early so that I can come down to read this book with this woman. I mean, she's the big boss in the state of Illinois for driver's license people. Can't she read? But, you know, I know to go along, get along, just be quiet and slip on by. So I say, okay, that'll be wonderful. Thanks. I haven't had a chance to read that yet myself. So I keep going to my meetings every day and telling my home group, and they do what you do. They just laugh and laugh. I'm really not impressed by any of this, you know. So in the meantime, I'm continuing to do everything else that they tell me to do. Go to meetings. Look at the steps. They didn't tell me to work the steps. They said, just look at them for a while. And my sponsor, who wasn't my sponsor yet, suggested that every time I go to a meeting, I pick up a piece of literature, just a pamphlet, and read it and bring it back the next day. And then he'd ask me about it every day. What did you read last night? That was not how I thought I was going to be getting sober. I really am a minimalist. You know, I like to do the minimal of everything. So, okay, so now I'm reading these pamphlets every day and I have to talk about them. I still don't have a clue about the steps. I'm still reading them. I don't really want to hear about God. I grew up Catholic, and you're right, it's a perception. I didn't have that perception of God. The perception I had of God was that when I die, we tally it up. If I had 51%, I won. I got to go to heaven. 49? Oh, well, you know. But between now and then, that was the priest's job. That wasn't mine. My job was to try to stay awake in church. You know, that was it. So, okay, so, yeah, God's there, but, you know, we're not talking. But I have this woman who makes me read every Monday and work. This went on for a full
year.
We actually got through the book twice. And, you know, at the end of the year, I was all excited. I said, I'm going to get a birthday cake. You know, I'm still not really working the steps. I'm kind of looking at them. I'm still not sure how it all works. But I'm stunned that I'm sober. I've never been able to stay sober because I couldn't stay sane when I stayed sober. I needed to drink to feel sane. And if you had the life I had, you'd have to drink too. And so I was stunned that I was actually sober. I was still going to work now 6 days a week. And I wasn't taking time off. And I was actually where I was supposed to be. That to me was just incredible. I've never been consistent at anything in my entire life. And so at the end of the year, I tell Evelyn, oh, you know, by the way, I'm going to get a cake next week. I'm going to have a year. And in my home group, you get to speak when it's your birthday. I'm very excited because I'm now somebody in AA, you know. When I came in, they didn't give you chips for all the different, you know, whiner chips is what we call them, you know. Oh, I've got, you know. Yeah, just keep them coming back, you know. So I was finally going to get my first chip at a year. I was just, you know, so of course I'm, woohoo, look at me, I'm really cool. And so I tell her all this and she said, oh, that's terrible. I said, why? She said, oh, we're having a meeting in Springfield that week. You have to come. All the hearing officers, and I'm thinking, you don't understand. And I know at this point, don't say that to her because, you know, she does think she understands and I just get more work to do. So I thought, this must be one of those resentments they talk about in AA, you know. So I went back to that man that, you know, is giving me all this literature every night. And so I say to him, I think I have a resentment. He said, great, we're going to write it down. I tell him what to do. I tell him what happened. He says, oh, dear, I know. A guy I sponsor and I, we'll go with you. We'll drive you down to Springfield. We'll find a meeting. We'll just go to a meeting on your birthday and we'll do a big deal when you get back. And I just, you know, that was one of the most generous things people ever did for me. And so he and a sponsor drove down to Springfield, Illinois for no good reason other than to make sure I wasn't alone on my birthday. I went to that meeting all day. I sat there. I tried to stay awake. I learned nothing new. And when I got out of that meeting, these two guys were standing there and they said, we found a meeting. We went to the meeting and lo and behold, there was my boss with a birthday cake waiting for me. And I learned the difference between a direct amend and an indirect amend. You know, an indirect amend every time I've tried one has made me feel good. You know, it's being nice to the people in the grocery store because I was really bratty to people and when I didn't care. That's an indirect amend. It always makes me feel good. A direct amend makes me responsible for my actions. It makes me stand up and say, this is who I am, and I'm really going to try to be better. The other half that step 9 talks about is that not only do we become responsible people, but we start to worry about the other guy. And you know, I have to tell you that I've lived in 8 states and 4 foreign countries since I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I finally got to travel and I remember it all now. And in that time, I've learned from every meeting I've gone to that you guys really do worry about other people more than yourselves. It's stunning. It is just stunning. It makes me so grateful. The love of my life passed away 7 years ago. I met him in AA. We're one of those boy meets girl on AA campus. And he's passed away, and I went to a meeting, and I was new in the town. Somebody made a pass at me. And it was like 3 days later, and all I did was sit there and cry and cry and cry, and I couldn't stop crying. And this guy came up to me. I didn't know him. Put his arm around me, and he said, honey, I can take you to a meeting where no boy will make a pass at you.
And so my home group, 7 years later, is a gay meeting hall in Palm Springs, California. And you know, they have worried more about me than they ever did about themselves. And those boys can worry a lot about themselves. And they have taught me more about loving in a direct way. And you know what else I learned about? People do the best they can. It's people do the best they can without God's help. And so I have to remember to keep God in this, or the best I can do is not very much. God bless you. Take care.